Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Yeah, g'day. Welcome to the program. Coming up today, Tasmanian lobster fishers using the national holiday to sell their produce and teaching the young about agriculture leads to recognition for one northwest Tasmanian farmer. It's the one way to get the kids to eat the vegetables, to have them grow them. We'll tell you that story. Coming up as part of the Australia Day Awards for Tasmanians. G'day, Tony, with you on the special Tuesday. Hope you're having a great day, whatever you might be doing. Let us know what's happening on the text line, 0438922936, 0438922936. Special day for Tasmania, with Grace Tame winning the Australian of the Year Award. It's also a special day for several other Tasmanians involved in agriculture in the state who've been recognised for their work. Wine industry veterans Terry and Rosemary Bennett have been awarded the Order of Australia in today's Australia Day Awards. The pair are owners of the Home Hill Winery at Ranelagh. The award recognises their service to the wine industry and to the local community. The couple chatted to Fiona Breen at their Huon Valley Vineyard.
We were so excited. We feel honoured now. We're still kind of pinching ourselves and thinking, this is not really happening to Terry and I. But we're going to receive the award with grace. And I think the Huon Valley community are going to be so excited for us. It's going to add to the Huon Valley, the prospects of the Huon Valley. It's probably going to put a little story out there that if you set yourself to doing something and doing it well and having enthusiasm and having the foresight to forge ahead, really good things come to you.
So, Terry Bennett, you received an email and you weren't really sure whether it was a hoax or whether it was real?
Well, all this spam mail going around, Fiona, it was a bit, but email came through and then I said to Rosemary and she said, oh, I got one too. I said, oh, it's only a scam. And anyway, we forgot about it. And probably a month later, we got more emails and... I don't really know a lot about the award, but it's an award that you don't put in for. I think someone must nominate you. So to that person out there in the valley somewhere or in Hobart that actually nominated Rosemary and myself, thank you very much. Yes, I feel very honoured and humbled.
Terry Bennett, how long have you been in the viticulture and winery business?
First vines were planted in 1992. Before that, the area where... main of the vines are planted today was orchard. I was an apple grower for many years until the European Common Market started and we couldn't get rid of our apples and the government then paid us a small amount to push the orchard out and then I went into cattle and from there planted a couple of rows of vines and it grew from there and now I think we have 11 hectares of vines. We've just planted another 5 hectares. The Pinot is our main grape. The area climate seems to suit it, but again, we live on the edge in the Huon Valley because of the frosts and in springtime, so from mid-September through to even mid-November, you can get that rogue frost that can come and wipe you out, but we have now irrigation over all the vineyards, so we're safe there. It's just a matter of getting up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and starting the irrigation up and hopefully your pump doesn't break down and you don't run out of water.
It's a big risk, isn't it? I mean, you were one of the earlier people to get into viticulture and the winery business down here in the Huon.
Yeah, Steve Lorenz at Craddock was probably the first at Panorama and Eric Phillips at elsewhere. I went for a drive one Sunday and saw the grapes growing down in Craddock at Steve Lorenz's place and had a talk to him and planted half a dozen rows. And I used to tend them of a weekend and all got out of hand. I thought, gee, I've got to push these grapes out or plant more and employ labour to maintain it because it all started to get too much. And it kind of took off from there. And even from our second vintage, the wine showed great potential. And since then, we've won the Jimmy Watson Trophy, which is the best two-year-old red wine in Australia. That was won with a 014 Pinot, and we've won the Tri-Nations and boutique wine shows, and so our trophy cabinet is fairly full at the moment.
Your passion's probably been tested in the last few years.
Certainly has. In 2019, the bushfires, the vines, the grapes took up the smoke, and it was like licking an ashtray. So we didn't make wine in 2019, so hence at the moment we have no Pinot left. But this season's looking good, and we hope to pick 50, 60 tonne of Pinot this year, which we can get back into the marketplace with.
Do you have that concern, Rosemary, about bushfires? Is it sort of on your mind at this time of year?
Probably today, yes, Fiona, because the bushfires started Glenhue on Jeeveston Franklin Way in 2019. I suppose over 3 or 4 days, it was quite low into our vineyard, but probably further north, someone lit bushfires there, and the smoke laid very, very low onto the vines. And I looked out the bedroom window and I thought, okay, I think we have got problems today. And I think that initial smoke bushfire probably caused our biggest problems, and that's why we couldn't harvest the grapes.
So a lot of hope for this season's vintage?
We are very positive people, and we are positive, yes, this season's going to be amazing. We did have a 2020 vintage, and that we've got the Pinot Noir in the barrels. Did a tasting on Friday, and is it excellent? It is excellent Pinot Noir.
How do you think this season will compare in terms of tonnage, Terry? Are you back up there?
Yeah, we're back up there, Fiona, but we're not even into Verizon yet. Like on the East Coast, you go around and you probably see red grapes, where we're about 3 weeks later than they do in Valley, Coal Valley, so they're far more advanced than we are. So, as I said, we live on the edge. We go in and we pick probably towards the end of April, sometimes first week in May. So you're up against the elements there. You can get rain, you can get a frost there then, and take your canopy away, because at that time of the year you can't irrigate to protect for the frost. So if you go to bed every night and think about that, you wouldn't sleep. So you think about the wine that's going to come out of the bottle the next vintage and say it's going to be better than we've ever done before. So it keeps you going.
Does keep you going, doesn't it? Terry and Rosemary Bennett from Home Hill Winery chatting to Fiona Breen about their Order of Australia award and the season to date for the wine industry. Congratulations to the pair. It's good to see a double award there. Well, Tasmania's berry industry was a vastly different landscape when Greg Hall was running his fruit business in the 1980s. It was long before polytunnels arrived on the scene, but formed part of a long and varied career in agriculture and the Tasmanian Parliament. Greg Hall has been recognised for service to both sectors in this year's Australia Day honours list.
I actually came back from Vietnam after I was called up as a national serviceman, and I came back, decided then to come back to the family farm. A little bit disappointingly, I think I should have gone to ag college in the first place, but my father had to have quite a major operation at the time, so that wasn't possible. So I came back. I've got to say, in those early years, in the early first 12 months, I was quite lost. It was a difficult time, having come out of potentially a combat zone in the middle of Southeast Asia and then coming back to a cold Tasmanian winter. But I think that great credit to my parents at the time, that they recognised that I had to have something to do pretty well straight away. We were dairy farming at the time, and then we gradually increased herd sizes, and at that time I think we got up to about 250 cows, which by today's standards is quite small. But eventually, we took good advice, developed water, and increased herd sizes and everything else.
When did the berry business start to take shape? How many years later?
It was a few years later. It was in the early 80s, and I decided I need more of a challenge, I think. And at the time, Piers Ranikar, who used to run the Tasmanian Smokehouse, had a lot of connections in terms of export, import. And Piers approached myself and a hatful of other farmers around the district to see whether we'd be interested in growing raspberries particularly, and looking at the export market to the US, because we're a southern hemisphere and obviously out of season to northern hemisphere markets. We went into that flying quite blind, I might say. It was a very steep learning curve going into horticulture.
Were they grown under tunnels at that point?
No. Oh, no. No. We were all outside. So we had all the elements to brave. We used to air freight all of our fruit, which in itself was a very interest in the experience. Eventually I decided, you know, this was, we had to do it a different way, and that's when we started with sea transport and palletising our fruit.
So you stuck with it for quite a while.
Yes, we did. And look, I've got to say, I think we did about 21 years thereabouts. And look, we had terrific support from locals. And I know the issues of sourcing labour these days on farm. But we were fortunate that virtually all of our workforce were locals, you know, about 50 a day. And we always appreciate that loyalty and support of that work ethic of those people who came out.
How did your work in agriculture then dovetail into your parliamentary career?
My parliamentary career was preceded by standing for the old Deloraine Council, as it was then, and then subsequently the Meander Valley Council. I had the opportunity to be part of the whole district, and that was an interesting experience for me. You know, I learnt a lot, and also the fact that being on the land, understood private enterprise, how things worked, and then it just proceeded from there.
Achievements most proud of during your time with the Legislative Council?
Oh, look, I mean, as an independent, I think we had it was a great role in the upper house to be an independent there, because at least you didn't have to follow the dictates of the parties. And it was interesting, I suppose you could say I came from a reasonably conservative background, being, you know, engaged in private enterprise. But it was interesting that often when legislation came forward, party members would come up to you and quietly say, oh, I hope you don't support that particular bit of legislation, even though it was their legislation. But they had nowhere to go because they were part of the party system. That's the way it is. And so I think coming out of a local government background where you voted on the issue and not the politics, then that was also very, very helpful. The Meander Dam, I think, was a game changer. It had been on the drawing board for some decades. There was a lot of controversy about channels cutting up farms and everything else, and I could understand that. But it came to the time where I thought this, you know, should go ahead. So I organised a very large public meeting at Deloraine. I think there were over 400 people there with very strong support, and that, I think, was a catalyst for starting to move things on. And Premier Jim Bacon at the time was a visionary, and we talked a lot, and he said, right, we're going to build this, and that's what happened. And so my role then, other people in the community, and, you know, I sort of singled out people like Jenny Dornoff and others who could see, had forward vision and thinking, got a committee going, and all those people really helped, and they assisted me in council. And then later on, when I was in Parliament, I was on the Public Works Committee to do the approval business. It was not without opposition, I might say, which held the whole job up for some time, which was a shame. But now, when you look around, it's been a fantastic... I mean, it gave environmental flow to the river, right from, you know, from where it starts right through to Launceston. It secured town water supplies, and it also provided irrigation water. And you've only got to look and just see how much investment has gone on in terms of irrigation infrastructure, dairies, you name it, and cropping, etc., because of having that secure water. And it was a precursor to a lot of the irrigation schemes around Tasmania.
What's retirement like?
I'm not really a good retiring person. No, I'm getting there. I've had to learn that and get involved in some local issues, you know, sort of. So I had a little bit of ill health, and I've had a couple of knee replacements, but I'm back on the bike again now. And so, which is great, because I can get round and cycle round, and I just look at awe in some of the, because on a bike you can look at everybody's farm. And not be critical, but you can see just say how much some of those younger people have gone ahead in leaps and bounds. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. You know, back in the 70s, I mean, the technology has changed so much. And the other thing that's changed so much is that we're operating in a very low interest rate environment. You know, we were operating in 18%. You know, and compared to today. So that makes it a lot easier for younger farmers, and particularly those who've had some tertiary training, to really get stuck into it. And, of course, then there's the corporate side of things, which, is, you know, has changed a lot of farming as well. Not just Chinese, of course, but Canadian pension fund money. A lot of Australian super funds are very gun-shy when it comes to lending, you know, or getting involved or investing in agriculture, but some of the other countries take a much longer-term view.
How do you feel about these Australia Day honours?
It is humbling, I've got to say. That's, you know, and you've really got to recognise the people who supported you, you know, particularly in my case, my wife, who had to keep the family, my wife Kathy, who had to keep the home fires burning, if you like, whilst I was away so much. And, you know, I had a very good long-standing employee of almost 40 years, Brian Morris, who worked for us, as well as other casuals. And without those sort of people and without those connections, being able to achieve other things, you just couldn't possibly do.
That's former farmer and independent MLC Greg Hall picking up an AM in the General Division for Service to the People, the Parliament of Tasmania, Agriculture and also Horticulture. He was chatting there to Larissa Smith. Well, Wilmot beef farmer John Burton has also been honoured with an Order of Australia Medal for his services to the community. He's volunteered at an array of community groups since the 1960s, including the Wilmot Cricket Club, and was responsible for cutting a number of bushwalking tracks in the region. He also helped introduce the world of agriculture to the next generation through his work on the Wilmot Primary School Farm Management Committee. Lachlan Bennett spoke to him about volunteering and life on the farm.
I took over the farm, the dairy side of it, in 88. Went out in 2000 from there in and went to beef. Still running beef cattle, and I've just retired from Lemon Time Lodge. I used to do maintenance there and drive tour buses at Cradle.
A lot of people would know you from those other activities, all the volunteering and community groups you're a part of. All of that must keep you very busy. Why have you gotten involved in so many different things and given up so much of your time?
I think it's just my love for the community. Very lucky that I've got an understanding family and wife that allows me to do those things.
And especially making time for that while you've got a working farm on the go. There wouldn't be too many people with many spare hours in the day to do all the work you do.
No, and working at Lemon Time Lodge as well, used to be coming home from there and then feeding cattle, and the rest of it used to keep me pretty busy. Yeah, keep me out of mischief. But yeah, no, it's I like to be busy, I guess. Keeps you fit and healthy. Very lucky that I can still play cricket. I mean, there's not many people at 70 can be playing.
Now, one of the things that you've been involved with for 35 years is the Wilmot School Farm. Is that all about, I guess, helping the next generation learn a little bit about what farming is, where their food comes from, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we've been pretty lucky because we've had the children grow their own veggies in a garden at the school, and some of them wouldn't eat their veggies, and now their mum comes and says that she can't get enough veggies for them, which is really good in that aspect. It does teach them in agriculture, and each year we donate so much to the school, pay for their trips away or books for the library and things like that from the school proceeds we make from the school farm.
When you hear stories like that about parents not being able to get enough veggies for their kids, I imagine it must be quite rewarding. And for
yeah,
you.
Well, when they grow their own, they want to eat their own, and so it's really been good for that, yeah. It teaches them that. I've also been involved in quite a few of the walking tracks out to the Four Falls. I cut that one.
And today's a pretty special day for you as well, being named an OAM.
Very special. You don't do these things for the accolades that come with it, but it's nice when it comes, yeah.
Now, I've talked to a fair few community organisations in my time, and one thing that always seems to come up is struggling to attract new members, younger members, to keep these initiatives going on. Do you have any thoughts on, I guess, the future of community organisations that rely on people like yourself?
Yeah. We were only talking about it the other night, the new president of the Tourism and Progress Association, and he's a councillor at Sheffield, and he was saying that they just can't get people to volunteer to do anything much, whereas our committee in Wilmot, he's never seen anything like it. He was commenting on all the volunteers that we get.
And what about you? You're 70. Are you going to be stopping your volunteering anytime soon?
Not if I can keep my health good enough, but I'll stick in there for a while yet, yeah.
Yeah, that's Wilmot farmer John Burton, who received an Order of Australia Medal this year for his services to the community. Well done. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll take you to the Margate Wharf in the south of the state, where one lobster fisher is selling off the boat while another fisher finalised preparations to head off to the west coast to grab more lobsters. But coming up next, reviving an old dairy farm in Tasmania's northwest. This is the Tasmanian Country Hour.
Trusted. The 2021 Australian of the Year is Grace Tame.
Well, hear me now. Using my voice amongst a growing chorus of voices that will not be silenced.
Tested.
Let's make some noise, Australia!
Resilient.
When you need to know the facts, turn to ABC Radio Hobart. It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Don't forget you can stay in touch with us on 0438 922 936, 0438 922 936, our text line number. Well, a former dairy is being restored to its former glory by a couple of new Tasmanians. Murray and Julie Williamson were chasing water, good soil and cooler temperatures when they moved from northeast Victoria to Tasmania 5 years ago. They purchased an old dairy in Rihanna and have been gradually restoring the operation. After 5 years, the hard work is finally starting to pay off.
Yeah, well, it was originally a dairy farm, then turned back into a cropping farm, and hadn't had cows milked on it for about 7 years before we arrived, so we had to rebuild the dairy, and we'd done that over a process of a few months before we came down here on once a month with a carload of fellas and come down here putting steel together and concreting and things. And yeah, so now we've got that going together and put the laneways back in and yeah, sort of turn it back into a dairy farm again.
There's a bit of fencing to be done, paddocks to be cleared, because obviously with cropping all the rocks came to the surface. So we used to go out and emu bop all the way around the place picking up rocks. Thus we have a lot of rock walls around the garden. But there's been quite a development done. We're still doing it. It's a process that we're slowly getting through them. The list seems to get a little bit shorter and then something gets added to it. So, yeah.
It's just a phenomenal amount of work you would have had to do to restore this farm. What were some of the challenges along the way?
Well, there was no effluent dams. We were used to, with up north where we were, we had turkey nests as far as effluent was gone. Down here when we came, we were spraying them out onto paddocks. Wasn't probably the best setup that we were comfortable with. We had platypus in our dam just here, and for us that was a huge thing. We used to have those when we were just out of Melbourne in the place where we lived, and we knew that all the runoff was going back into that dam, and so we got a Landcare grant and put in some effluent ponds, and we're able to now use it part of our irrigation system. So
yeah, we spread the effluent right around the farm now, and yeah, we keep it all on farm and make use of the nutrients. And yeah, looking at the grass, you can see the difference where we put it. So no, it's all coming together, and yeah, we're learning more as we go.
What's the biggest difference between here and where you were in Victoria?
Just the climate. Just, you know, like last year we had 1,200 mil of rain. Like, and I think our average up there in the Alps was about 400. And our use of water for the irrigation, I think we use about a megalitre a cow here, and we used to use 3 up there, and 3 megalitres in northern Victoria last year would have cost you around $1,800 a megalitre. So we're sort of making money out of savings. Really, that's sort of why we're here. And the grass just keeps on happening, and yeah, no, it's good farming.
You've put a lot of work into this property over the last 5 years. Could you tell me where you are at this point and how you're feeling about the future?
Oh, I think we're just at the point now of starting to push our growth of pasture forward. Just trying a few different things, double cropping, and no, there's plenty of crops I think we can grow here yet. Just play around and be farmers, and sometimes it won't work every time, but we'll hopefully most of the time.
We've still got laneways to do. We've got major laneway work to be done. As you can imagine, if the place was under crop, the paddocks were only the laneways were only being used for driving on. So, you know, once cattle have been on it and a couple of wet winters, we've got some Grand Canyons in the laneway. So we thought, well, we've got a that's our newest our latest investment we'll be doing over this
summer.
So yeah, and fencing, we're concentrating on boundary fences because with no cattle on the place, we've been cropping, it wasn't a necessity, where if they needed to get a piece of machinery in, they cut the fence. So we're concentrating on those two things at the moment, as well as the pastures and stuff. It's just like a continuous roll of paper, just with the amount of jobs that we've got to get done through ourselves, putting pressure on ourselves to get done, but we're getting there. We're getting there.
Any regrets?
I don't think so, not at this stage. It's all been a great journey up till now. Yeah, moving wasn't easy. A new venture doesn't hurt the soul to learn a lot of different new stuff, and just trying to get the farm up and going and be a sustainable business, I suppose you could say.
And recuperate that capital that we lost with the irrigation costs and stuff up in Victoria. We had eating into equity to try and pay bills, which is always a road to disaster. So having to get back on our feet that way. Probably the only regret, one aspect, is leaving the family behind. But then again, was another regret, we should have done it earlier. So...
Oh, no, we're just happy on our journey at the moment, and yeah, we'll just want to progress, and where it takes us to, we'll find out as we go.
It's Victorian and Tasmanian farmers Murray and Julie Williamson speaking about their restoration of their Ryanna dairy in the northwest. Time now to check the latest on the weather with Michael Conway from the Bureau. G'day, Michael.
Hi, Tony.
Strange weather we're having, hot and then cooling down and then a bit of rain, a bit of everything.
Yeah, and it was a warm night over last night, wasn't it? Especially down in the southeast. I think it got down to about 17 degrees in Hobart, so it was quite warm for this time of year. Oh, we're in summer, what am I saying? It should be warm, but that's about 5 degrees above average.
Yeah, if you're a mainlander listening to this, you're thinking 17, that's cold.
Yeah, that's right.
Rainfall, what have we got?
Yeah, so as the trough went through yesterday, there was some good falls about. The highest being Pine Tree Rivulet, got 35 mils up on the western tiers there and the central plateau got the highest falls. Lake Wendy got 32, and out west Strawn got 28. In the southeast, the highest fall was Tasman Island, they got 25 mils. In the cities, Hobart received 4 mils and Launceston 8 mils. Since 9 a.m, there's been a few falls. Grey has had about 4 mils. Flinders Island's had one. There's a few more showers right at the moment in the northeast and along the west and far south, just some very light showers. We expect those to continue to the rest of the day and mainly fine other than the west and northeast there. And then tomorrow, the showers will be similar sort of areas, so west and far south in the morning, but other than that, fine. What's happening is a particularly interesting-looking low way to our south, but it's fairly close, is going to move away towards the east into the Tasman Sea, and that's bringing these sort of west to southwesterly winds we're having across the state. That'll move over into the Tasman Sea tonight and into tomorrow, and then we'll get a high-pressure system coming over to our south the next couple of days, which will make the weather quite mainly fine. But as the high moves into the Tasman Sea on Friday, we're going to get some decent rain developing about the north, so possibly some heavy falls up there along the northwest coast. We're looking at perhaps around 25-35 mils on Friday as a northeasterly flow, quite a moist northeasterly flow develops. And in the northeast, similar sort of rainfalls there as well. So quite an interesting weather day Friday.
Yeah. Okay. Warnings. What have we got?
Today there's gale warnings out for lower eastern and southern coastal waters from Wineglass Bay to Low Rocky Point. Strong wind warning is current for the remaining coastal waters from St Helens Point to Cape Portland. Tomorrow gale warning for the lower east coast from Wineglass Bay to Tasman Island. And then strong wind warning for remaining northern, eastern and southern coastal waters from Stanley to Low Rocky Point.
Okay, Michael, and the coastal waters and swell, what can we expect over the next couple of days?
Sure. So today the winds west to southwesterly is about 15 to 25 knots, although more south to southeasterly about the east coast, they're increasing to 20 to 30 knots from late morning, and reaching 35 knots in the south and lower east from late afternoon. Seas 1 to 2 metres, building to 2 to 3 in the north and 3 to 4 in the south by the late afternoon. Tomorrow we've got south to southwesterlies, 20 to 30 knots, reaching up to 35 knots about the lower east coast in the early morning. Winds tending south to southwesterly, 15 to 25 in the west, and easterly 15 to 25 in the north. Seas 2 to 3 metres, 3 to 4 metres in the southeast. The swells in the west and south, we're looking at a southwesterly swell, 1 to 2 metres, increasing to 2 to 3 metres, increasing to 3 to 4 metres from late today into tomorrow, decreasing a little to 2 to 3 tomorrow afternoon. In the north, just the westerly under a metre. In the east, northeasterly about 1 to 2 metres, and also a southerly to southwesterly swell, picking up today to 1.5 to 2 metres and then easing a bit. Increasing south to southwesterly 2 to 3 metres offshore in the south tomorrow.
Okay, Michael, thank you for that.
No worries. See you, Tony.
See you later. Michael Conway from the Bureau with the latest information for you on what that weather is going to do. So it's going to settle down over the next couple of days, and then Friday we might get a bit wet, especially in the northwest and the north of the state. Some heavy rainfalls predicted there. We'll keep you detailed on that over the next couple of days. Now, just to mention that Richard Bailey's normally on tomorrow, Wednesday, but won't be on tomorrow because there's no sale today at Powerenna, being Australia Day, the public holiday. So no Richard Bailey on tomorrow's Country Hour program, but Richard will be back with us on Friday, that's for sure and certain. Okay, we'll talk lobsters and what's happening with Australia Day and the lobsters in just a moment. This is the Tasmanian Country Hour.
Roses are red, violets are blue. If your child writes a poem, they can win money too.
Yep, in the brand new Liffey Youth Poetry Prize. I'm Helen Shield from Your Afternoon, partnering with 10 Days on the Island for their new competition. There are two categories, 8 to 12-year-olds and 13 to 18, and a $400 cash prize for each. Winners will present their poems at 10 Days and on Your Afternoon.
Yay!
Find the details and enter online, abc.net.au/Hobart. Entries close February 12.
On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And don't forget, you can stay in touch with us on the text line number of 0438 922 936, 0438 922 936. Now, coming up shortly, we'll take you to Outback Queensland, where it's an environment where you wouldn't expect grapes to be grown, but they are growing grapes in the outback. We'll tell you all about that story in a few minutes from now. Well, normally lamb is associated with the Australia Day gatherings and barbecues, but the lobster industry has added a bit of spice to the debate this year with its marketing campaign, Have a Crave for Australia Day. Around Tasmania, lobster fishers are selling their produce after the collapse of the Chinese market, including Kent Way, who is using the Margate Wharf in the state's south to sell his lobsters. Fiona Breen caught up with Kent Way this morning.
We did really well last Australia Day. We sold a lot of lobsters to the public, and we thought we'd try again this year.
So how are you going so far? It's only early.
It is early. We have been here for 3 days trying to sell the lobsters. It's been a little slow, $50 a kilo.
So that's a little less than what you might normally sell them for.
Definitely, yeah.
In normal times,
and yeah, we're just doing a just Australia Day special, one off today.
Well, it's not normal times for lobster fishers, is it?
No, not at all. A lot's changed in the last 12 months. Been affected many different ways.
A bit tough.
Yeah, it has been tough. Yeah, we didn't start work until January. We were just waiting to see what was happening with the market and the fish that were coming in. We've got one more trip to do after this one, and then we'll wait till March.
And that's the new season, the new quota?
The new quota season. I don't think much will change by then. Some of our processors are working really hard to find new markets into other countries, and we've been selling a lot on the domestic market into Australia as well.
So normally some of your lobsters would have gone to China?
Yes, yep, 75% of our lobsters went to China and the rest in Australia.
So how is this affecting your bottom line?
It's gone downhill quite a lot. So in some ways, when we lease quota, we're not paying as much for quota. We were paying as much for quota as what we're receiving for our lobsters now. So that's brought the quota price back, but the overall bottom line has dropped.
Are you making a profit?
Not on this trip. On the last trip we did, the price has dropped in the last couple of weeks. And due to the resurgence of COVID on the mainland, a lot of the restaurants, pubs, clubs are all working at restricted numbers, and that's what's affected us the most in the last month.
So since New South Wales has had troubles, and then of course Brisbane and Queensland?
Yes, all through those areas. But they buy a lot of our lobster in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and they generally pay as high a price or higher for certain months of the year than the overseas market.
So what's next for you? Another trip out for this season. Where do you head out to?
We fish mainly southern Tasmania and up the west coast, and we do some trips on the eastern towards Flinders overall for a year.
So it's still worthwhile going out?
We've got quota on the vessel that we have to pay for. So I'm better off to go and catch it and make a small loss than a big loss.
At least you're paying the bills.
We're paying the bills, we're paying the quota owners, and the employees have got work.
And what about your staff? Have you had to lose any staff, or are you able to pay them normally?
Yes, we applied for JobKeeper and had that for a number of months, and that worked well. And with some of the other government assistance, it has been helpful, and we've retained all our staff. And they, we've been able to find a little bit of other work as well in between trips.
But I bet the family members are working hard.
Yes, I've had a daughter, a son, a second son, and my smallest child, who's only 8 down here, and my wife helping me sell lobsters.
Is that normal, or is it all hands on deck in these tough times?
We try to get together and all help one another. So if we see another fisherman selling lobsters to the public here and he's a bit overwhelmed, we'll run along and give him a hand. So it's just a matter of all chipping in and all surviving.
And how are the public embracing the idea of cheaper lobsters?
Oh, they're loving it. So, we've had a lot of customers that are really happy to get some lobsters at a reasonable price. And we've had a lot of people over the last couple of weeks from Melbourne and South Australia and Brisbane here, and they're enjoying the product as well.
What do you think will be the end result of all this? Do you think things will change for the lobster fishers in terms of markets, etc.?
I don't know whether it'll ever go back to being the same. So it's a matter of just pulling the belt in, waiting maybe 12 months, 2 years, unless our government can sort something out. I just feel like it's a bit of a reset for us to start again, look at new markets, get the price back to a realistic price where we all can keep working and supply a good product at a reasonable price.
So it might be a few more for locals for a while yet?
I would think so, yes. No, there'll be plenty for the locals. And basically, we can catch more than what the local market can eat. So
you need those other markets
we,
as well.
We need the other markets as well, yeah.
Yeah, lobster fisher Kent Bray, who was spending his Australia Day on the Margate Wharf selling the lobsters, talking there to Fiona Breen. Well, at the same time at Margate, another lobster fisher was preparing to head across to the west coast to catch more quota in time for the Chinese New Year celebrations.
I'm Clive Perryman, and I fish the Minamara 2 from Margate.
You're about to head out. Tell me where you're going and what you're planning to do.
Yeah, well, I'm heading up around the west coast. The weather pattern looks too good to stay home. We've been staying home for too long now, and we want to get inshore and get some really nice big red lobsters because Chinese New Year's coming up, and we feel that that's our best chance to move some fish.
So Chinese New Year, that's in about the 12th of February, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's around the 12th, 14th of February, and it normally runs for a bit over a week, about 10 days.
And you'll be targeting interstate Chinese?
Yeah, pretty sure the local market hopefully will sort of pick up a little bit and there'll be some more demand, just like there was at Christmas time on the mainland. As long as we don't have any coronavirus outbreaks on the mainland that stop people going out and enjoying a good meal.
So you've got a nice vessel here, but you'll actually be hopping in your dinghy to get these fish?
Yeah, so the
a
weather...
A bit closer to shore? Or?
Yeah, so normally we fish off the deck. Off the boat, but when the weather's too good to get inshore, we take the dinghy off and we get in all the little nooks and crannies where you find the really big, nice, bright red fish.
So you know that market really likes those bright red fish, and you're hoping to get a premium price?
Well, just hoping to shift them. At the moment, that's the best chance to shift fish. So we're just going to go out and target big red fish.
So how many are you looking for? Because you've got... not that much longer to fish your quota for the season.
Yeah, so time's running out and we need to catch the rest of our quota, otherwise that's just money down the drain. So we just have to take what we can, but just give ourselves every chance to get the best price. The big red fish are giving us probably another $5, maybe $6, $7 on top of what the deeper brindley coloured fish are getting.
So what are your thoughts about the future market? It's you're all at a bit of a holding pattern at the moment.
Yeah, it's a bit of a holding pattern, but we still have bills coming in and we have to pay for them. So we're still heading out and trying to trickle over a little bit of cash flow. It's very uncertain at the moment and we don't know where it's going to end up.
Breaking even?
Probably going backwards, really. I'm pretty much living off my tax return from last year.
And hoping things improve.
Yeah, no, definitely hoping things improve. We've seen downturns before, but this is a definite targeted approach to control the market. And I know China's been our main market, but it's pretty hard to all of a sudden just diversify into others when they're not willing to pay the same sort of price. And when investment in a quota and boats and things, you have to get a certain amount to cover costs.
So you'll be selling some locally as well?
Yep, so basically I've been talking to my processor. He'll probably take half of what I bring in and then I'll try and shift the other half off the jetty if I can. But then there's competition with other boats and we're all trying to work in with each other, but that gets a little bit hard and at times.
Do you think locals have still got the taste for them?
I think the locals do, but now it's being sort of, I guess there's been a flood of fish, and I think they've, you know, basically, I wouldn't say they've had enough of them, but like, you can only eat so much lobster. You'd have to be a real, fan of them to be eating them every day.
Oh, look, throw them my way every day, wouldn't mind. Lobster fisher Clive Perryman talking to Fiona Breen as he was about to head out to sea and the West Coast to catch lobsters for the Chinese New Year celebrations next month. Very much a balancing act for the lobster fishers, isn't it? The great unknown. A big gamble whether to go out to sea to catch more or not. Now, if you go to our ABC Rural online page, there's a story there from Western Australia about a family from WA Midwest fishing community of Leeman. They've been ordered to pay more than $70,000 in fines and costs after selling 76 black market Western Rock lobsters to undercover officers during an operation between June 2018 and April 2019. A 67-year-old man and his 67-year-old wife and a 29-year-old son were selling the black market Western Rock lobsters via the local country club. The magistrate said the sales were intentional and definitely for profit, and they were charged after that 10-month undercover investigation. So very costly for that particular family in the lobster industry. Still to come, bringing water to one of the driest areas of Australia means new crops can be grown, and it's an area where you'd least expect to find grapes growing. That's coming up for you on the Tasmanian Country Hour.
The threat of COVID-19 means we all need to prepare a little differently this year for any emergencies that may impact us and our communities. To reduce the risk of transmission of COVID-19 amongst large gatherings in evacuation centres, your first option if you need to leave home should be staying with family and friends out of your area. For ideas, visit ABC Emergency online and stay connected with your emergency broadcaster, ABC Radio Hobart. Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, Outback Queensland isn't typically the environment you'd associate with horticulture. It's hot, dusty, with little surface water, but underground reserves of the liquid gold do exist. It's just a not-so-simple process to identify and tap them, and then, of course, to get government approvals. But that's exactly what the town of Hughenden has done, and now paddocks at its 15-mile irrigated agricultural development have been taken up a major southern grape grower to farm early season springtime grapes when most Australian grocers stock only Californian grapes. Tom Major has this report.
A heavy plough toils in the hot sun, breaking ground on virgin soil alongside the Flinders River. The hot inland town of Hughenden isn't exactly where you picture fresh, crispy grapes coming from. The region's known primarily for sheep and cattle, but it's also ideal for early season fruit due to its warm climate, and now the Flinders Shire might have to add a bunch of grapes to its crest. More than a decade after it was first proposed, ground is being prepared northwest of the town for 60 hectares of table grapes to be planted by Mildura-based Marciano that will fill a critical gap in the national harvest between spring and early summer, when most grapes are imported from California. Manager Maritz Duplessis is Marciano's local manager, who says the project will be a challenging but exciting one for him personally.
It's nice to put a personal touch on a greenfield project and get something of this magnitude up and running and being productive. Yes, that's a good challenge.
So the most important thing is the water. How are the bores flowing?
Yeah, at this stage we haven't equipped them, but we've got all tests on them and volume capacity. So that's the main reason why we're here, because we've got access to secure water. And we'll pump them into a central storage area and pump out of that. It'll be a central distribution dam, yes.
Just how much water will these grapes require?
So irrigation-wise and frost and heat protection, we're looking about 13 megs a hectare a season.
When you begin to put these grapes in the ground, where are they actually coming from? What sort of varieties are they, and whereabouts are they being grown or grafted or whatever you do with them first?
So they'll come out of nurseries in Victoria or down south that's affiliated with us, and it'll be basically white, red and black seedless grapes.
You mentioned the frost and probably more importantly the heat. Just how important will climate control be in this project?
For us, climate control will probably come in more for heat closer to harvest. If you have heat waves at that time of the year, we want to make sure we have a nice, fresh, crispy grape to pick and to send off.
What other sort of infrastructure has to go in before picking can begin, and what sort of timeline do you have to plan that development?
So basically we're sitting on a 24-month development plan now in which we'll be basically starting from trailer systems and irrigation and the dam, and then after that it'll be basically packing sheds, accommodation for workers, core workers on the farm, and machinery sheds.
First harvest, all going well, when will that be?
So we're aiming for our first harvest in planting this spring, then 18 months after that, so 12 to 18 months, so it'll be August, October, November 2022.
Maritz Duplessis, he's farm manager at Marciano Grapes at their new Hughenden farm. Now the process to tap alluvial aquifers, plus gain a licence to access Great Artesian Basin water if required, was an exhaustive one for Flinders Shire Council. Council outlaid several million dollars to develop the 15 mile, with some additional support from the Department of State Development through its Jobs and Regional Growth Fund, as well as the government designating the 15 mile as a coordinated project, assisting with the difficult task of obtaining environmental, cultural heritage and water extraction approvals. Mayor Jane McNamara says the large investment will be a worthwhile one to plan for Hughenden's future growth and reverse 60 years' worth of gradual population decline.
It's in the vicinity of probably $4.5 to $5 million that council has invested here, because obviously being a greenfield site, we had to go through at what we called an IAR, and then it became a state coordinated project. But once it became a coordinated project with Marciano family on board with it, this is pivotal to making the world sit up and go, the north of Australia, the north of Queensland, can become part of the food bowl. We just have to do it smart. We have to make sure that the water is used in a really sustainable manner, and because there is limited water.
Have there been learnings from this project, the many, many years that Council has put into it, that can assist with future irrigation schemes, potentially even the HIPCO project in the future?
Definitely, this is a pilot program for the HIPCO project, and you know, we support the HIPCO project because, you know, a dam anywhere on the Flinders is going to be beneficial to the whole development of North Queensland. Definitely this has been a pilot program that has helped them in their deliberations in what they do as well. So for us, it's more about actually getting the Shire noticed for having high-value ag, not just because we've been trying to diversify the economic viability and the sustainability of our Shire and our community. And that's been really, really important. And if this can be duplicated then across the north, we've helped with the development of northern Queensland.
How many jobs are in this for Huindon?
It's around about 70, and then ramping up when they're doing the picking. So that'll be a window of time when there will be up to about 150 people within that time frame, yes.
Jane McNamara from Flinders Shire. Now, Council plans to next approach government for assistance with CSIRO studies into future water storage opportunities in some of those local alluvial aquifers. And who knows, next spring you could be crunching a fresh Huindon grape between your teeth on a hot day.
Yeah, who knows? Tom Major ending that report from Huindon in outback Queensland, where ground has been broken after a decade-long project to bring horticulture to that particular very dry district. If you go to our ABC Rural online page, you'll find a very interesting story from overseas, from Denmark, as a matter of fact, once the world's top exporter of mink furs. Now, they've offered to pay the nation's mink farmers up to 19 billion Danish crowns, which is around $4 billion, following an order last year to cull the country's entire mink population. So that story is on our ABC Rural online page. Don't forget our ABC Facebook page too, our ABC Rural Facebook page, and we will have a podcast of today's program up for you very shortly. Now, don't forget tomorrow too that because there's no sales today, no livestock sales, Richard Bailey will be on the radio on Friday only and not tomorrow. That's the Country Hour for today. Catch you after midday tomorrow.